Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Naturalist Capitalist. I am, as always, your host, Reed Coverdale, and I am very excited to have on the other end. He is the host of the Reason interview. He works at Reason Magazine. You guys all know him. He's like the, I'd say, the mainstream ambassador to the world for libertarianism. Nick Gillespie, how are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Reed. It's always nice to be in the mainstream, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate you joining me. We were talking before we started the stream. Everyone has a different story to how they got to libertarianism. Most of the people I know, it was through Ron Paul with the Giuliani moment. They all have a moment like that. I didn't really have a moment. I was kind of a slow evolution, and it was in an off season. It was after the 2012 election. Rand Paul kind of caught my attention with his filibuster of John Brennan. And then I started opening up my mind to different people that I hadn't listened to before. And Bill Maher was one of the shows I ended up watching. I know a lot of people might find that surprising, but he actually kind of made me start questioning conservatism in general. And then I saw you on his show. That's how I found out about you and started looking more into libertarianism. And that kind of put me on my way. But I was wondering, how did you get into libertarianism? How long have you been in this fight? How did it all start?
So it's funny. I just saw my older brother for the first time in about a year and a half and yesterday, and he was the guy who did it. He went away to college. He went to Rutgers College in New Jersey, which is where Milton Friedman actually went, like in the 1920s or 30s. And he found Reason Magazine at the college bookstore and then started sending it to me and saying, like, hey, you know what? I think you might like this. And I started reading that, and I was like hooked in high school. And I actually had a subscription through college, and I worked as a journalist in New York, which is where I'm calling from right now. And I just kept up with Reason and went back to grad school in the late 80s and started realizing this was at the beginning of what was then called political correctness. And it was, you know, the first wave of what now we talk about as woke, you know, woke scholarship or woke thought. And I started taking things much more seriously. Like, I'd called myself a libertarian. I was in favor of things like open borders. I thought the Cuba embargo was stupid. I thought drugs should be legal. I thought alternative lifestyles, however you define that, should be legal. But going to grad school for literary studies and cultural studies in the late 80s and early 90s, I realized I needed a kind of a real ideology to kind of push back against kind of a leftism. I knew I wasn't a conservative, and I really became libertarian, mostly as a result of Reason. And I'll throw in the other thing is, after I worked as a journalist for a few years before going to grad school, and when you are a cub reporter on newspapers, you get stuck going to things like planning board meetings and zoning board meetings, and seeing this was mostly in small towns in New Jersey, and just seeing how local regulators, local, you know, zoning board people in particular, would kind of shit on everybody who was coming, like, you know, like homeowners who had had fucked up and like done something to their house without getting a permit, you know, because they didn't even know you needed a permit to like put a fence up or something. It would make my blood boil, you know, just seeing like not only were they going to make the people dig up everything and do it again and get a permit and pay a fine, but they would lecture people about like, how dare you think you can just do anything you want to your property. I can remember these meetings, you know, and it'd be like, are you kidding? Of course you should be able to, you know, make an addition to your house or whatever. It's your, you know, it's your house. So it was mostly through Reason. And then, going back to school and getting, on that first wave of, you know, the people I went to grad school with are now the professors who are teaching, you know, woke kind of studies. So,
yeah. Yeah. How has that journey been with the whole woke nonsense? Because I know you go on Bill Maher's show a lot. And, you know, it seems to oversimplify things because the woke nonsense is so, it's just so repulsive that we're starting to break things down into woke and non-woke. And philosophy as a result is starting to die a little bit. I mean, if you are Tulsi Gabbard or Bill Maher, or Dave Smith or Ron DeSantis. Like, a lot of people will just put you in one group. It's like you're against the machine, and it's kind of killing all of the nuance. Is that a problem you've seen arise with all the
different— Yeah, you know, I mean, American political discourse has never been known for its nuance. And, you know, there's always two, you know, there's 2.5 categories, and like how you get thrown into one. And I'd say libertarians are like that half category. And one of our challenges is to, you know, become a third category or take over one of the, you know, the full groupings. And what, how you get slotted into stuff depends. And it's, you know, fascinating to me, because one of the great libertarian victories, I think, of the past 20 years, or even maybe the past 50 years, is a, you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard, and this is also somebody like Rand Paul, who, you know, Rand Paul is very conservative. He's a Republican. Ron DeSantis is a conservative and a Republican, but different than Paul or Gabbard in that I assume Ron DeSantis is totally pro-war. One of the great libertarian victories is being anti-war and getting a majority of people in America to be like, you know what, this idea that America needs to be the indispensable nation and has to spend, you know, more than all the other countries in the world on defense and be in, you know, 800 countries, you know, and in foreign space, you know, in outer space with military hardware. You know, we've won that argument. I mean, we haven't won the policy battle, but, you know, the hearts and minds are like, yeah, we need to change the way we do defense. But somebody like Tulsi Gabbard gets shunted aside. She's a commie on virtually everything except free speech and, you know, and foreign policy. But for that reason, she gets put into a bad category, or a category with people she doesn't have anything to do with. So,
Yeah, the anti-war thing's been weird. I mean, we felt like there was a big movement under George W. Bush, but it seems to have been more of an anti-George W. Bush movement. Yeah. When Tulsi Gabbard would talk about how the Democrat Party used to be the party of peace, I was like, when?
That isn't quite true, but it was that, you know, at least there were at various points after the Cold War, maybe. Now it gets harder and harder to think about this, but, you know, there has always been an anti-war or a non-interventionist. I don't use the term isolationist, because I know I'm not an isolationist, and I know that most libertarians I know and most anti-war people, they're not isolationists in that, you know, they don't think America has any interests outside of our own borders. We shouldn't trade with people. You know, we should never go to war or anything like that. It's non-interventionism. And that's always been a significant part of American thinking, with the exception of World War II after Pearl Harbor. There has always been a strong non-interventionist impulse in America. And then where that ends up changes. You know, Bob Dole in 1976, when he was running as Gerald Ford's vice presidential candidate, he ranted about all these Democrat wars because, you know, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam had all been sort of by Democratic presidents. The Cold War was a bipartisan, you know, Cold War interventionism was a bipartisan consensus. After the end of the Cold War, you had people like Bill Clinton, who was very interventionist. It allowed for a right-wing anti-intervention or non-interventionist moment for a brief, you know, for like a cup of coffee, because W. Bush was bad news on that front, as bad as it gets. But we realized pretty early on, you know, it did seem in the early 2000s that there was a vibrant anti-war movement. But the minute that John Kerry emerged, even in 2004, who was a guy who had, you know, he was in favor of every intervention, you know, basically including Vietnam for a good chunk of his life his young life, you know, the left crapped out, you know, because they're not they don't have a principled non-interventionist perspective. They were merely anti-Bush and anti-Republicans.
Yeah, I think a personification of that is kind of Bill Maher. And I wanted to talk about him just because he was a really influential person when I first started changing my mind. And no one seems really able to pin him down, including myself. Like, he's not really anti-establishment, but then he'll occasionally say something that's just really against the grain that you want to stand up and cheer for him. And then sometimes he's you know, super critical of the Democratic Party. And then the next day he's talking about how they're the best thing in the world. And he just kind of drives everyone crazy. And I'm able to detach myself from people that I've learned from or that I've associated with. I don't feel like I have to follow them everywhere they go. So for me, that's okay. But for so many people, he makes them want to pull their hair out. And I know you've been on his show many times. So yep. What do you think about Bill Maher? What's your take on him?
You know, he in the 90s, when he was doing Politically Incorrect back on Comedy Central, and then it moved to ABC before he ended up getting kicked off of that and right after 9/11 and ended up on HBO, you know, which is like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, we had a show, Politically Incorrect, and he's generally liberal. At various points, he called himself libertarian, and yeah. I think there's definitely some libertarian elements and tendencies in him. But he's, you know, he's kind of, you know, more a person of the left. He wants socialized health care. He likes a lot of government intervention, where he is great. And by the way, he's, you know, he's bad, or I disagree with him on foreign policy, because he's, you know, after 9/11 and more generally, he seems to be very comfortable with, you know, American military might kind of going mm-hmm. in and fixing things, which never quite works out. But where he is essential, I think, are in two ways in the related. One is that his show, and, you know, now we're talking like 30 years, man, you know, where he has put on one of the rare talk shows where people of all political persuasions actually get to yap for a while on equal footing. And, you know, I'm not saying this simply because I've been on his show a bunch of times, and my colleague and co-author Matt Welch of Reason has also been on. But, you know, that's like one of the few places where you see legitimate representatives of different points of view on, like, where he's not just pulling in nutbags, you know, from the religious right to, right. you know, hold up conservative things, or, you know, he doesn't bring in wackadoo libertarians. Like, he brings in, you know, people who are pretty, you know, who are good, I think. So that's great. And then the other thing is, and this has always been true for him, but especially over the past couple of years, you know, he's such a free speech warrior. And in that way, I think that's this probably the single most important issue for all of this stuff, because and especially now, because, you know, we have big tech companies that are looking to kind of, you know, fudge or put English on the cue ball while they're pretending to be straight down the middle for free speech and free expression, but they're not. But more importantly, we have politicians on the Republican side and the Democratic side who are really anti-free speech and free expression. And Maher has been absolutely great on that issue forever. And I think it's really important. He's a, you know, a kind of liberal guy who I think libertarians can certainly work with and actually learn a lot from.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think people need to take the good that you can get out of somebody. Yeah. You know, people tend to be so black and white. If someone's perfect on everything, I'll listen to them. If they suck on one thing, they're out the window.
And yeah, I mean, and, you know, just to yammer on, you know, you asked earlier, like, how I became a libertarian, and it was like through reading Reason. And I went, I think every, you know, a lot of people do this, where you go through a phase where you are, or one is extremely doctrinaire. And I, you know, I know for a long time, I kind of thought, okay, you know, maybe there's like 10 major policies that libertarians believe in. And if you, it wasn't even like if you did 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10, you were libertarian. It was like if you were off, if you disagreed with what I thought the libertarian catechism was on one issue, it's like, screw you. You're not libertarian at all. And you're worse, you know, than a conservative or a liberal right. who agrees with me on two things. I've become over time to think more about libertarian as an adjective or as a direction. It's a temperament. It's a mindset. It's a default setting. Do you believe in, you know, that the individual should have more autonomy, more real choices to make, more power to live their lives however they want? And if you start with that, you're pretty libertarian. I tend to use libertarian now as an adjective, not as a noun. And I think, you know, that would help us as a, both as a cultural force, but also a political force, because, you know, especially in politics, everybody is terrible on, like, you know, probably a majority of things, or you know, people who get elected to office. So you've got to work with people where they are, and you can't expect, you know, perfect uniformity.
Yeah, I totally agree. Since we got into censorship and free speech a little bit, I know you did have a video removed from YouTube. It was called "Biohackers Are on a Secret Hunt for the Coronavirus Vaccine." And libertarians, you know, we all pretty much agree that we don't want the government regulating free speech. Right. But for some reason, people take that as though we can't criticize these tech companies for what they're doing, saying that they suck. Tom Woods was on my show, and he was talking about how it's like going into a restaurant where you order a rare steak and it comes out well done. You're obviously going to complain. You're not going to say, oh, it's a private company, I don't have any say in you know, how my product is or whatever. But is that the first big strike they've made against you guys? And what are your thoughts on?
You know, in terms of content, we at various points have had like some copyright issues, most of which are phony. I by the way, I'm a like an IP anarchist for the most part. But, you know, at once YouTube, and this was early on in its tenure, once it was bought by Google, it started enforcing copyright and stuff like that. You know, and that's fine. It is their sandbox. They get to, you know, they get to make the rules. A lot of their rules are arbitrary and stupid. And the reason they gave for taking down this biohacking video, you know, was that it was spreading COVID misinformation that had been up for over a year. And it had been kind of rendered moot by the fact that messenger RNA vaccines had come along. And like, you know, we're not talking about the hunt for, you know, do-it-yourself vaccines or even big pharma vaccines. You know, that topic has changed. I assume that what happened was that they have, you know, various bots that go through and look for keywords and they can also scan video. And, you know, and it got flagged. We, you know, when they took it down, we appealed the decision and they were like, no, you know, it's still down. And, you know, it's a bad decision. I'm a big fan of, there's a guy named Albert Hirschman. He was a political economist in the early 70s. He wrote a book called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, which was about how do you deal with, God, what were the terms? It was like states, firms, and organizations in decline. And he said, you know, you've got three basic, you know, things you can do. You can go with loyalty, where when a company or a country that you're part of starts becoming awful, you just suck it up and you become a company man, or it's like America, love it or leave it. You don't criticize anything. You do as you're told. You can exercise voice, which is you scream bloody murder, and kind of what Woods is talking about. You know, this is like, you know, when your favorite restaurant takes your menu item off the menu, you know, you don't just say like, oh, well, that's that. You know, you right. say, you know, what the hell? I mean, you petition them, you scream, you use whatever, you know, kind of appeal system is in place to plead your case and to change things. Or, you know, then you go with exit, which is that you say, OK, fuck it, I'm out of here and I'm moving. You know, I'm moving from France to America. I'm you know, I'm going to the frontier. I'm taking off for Mars. You know, figuratively, mostly, at least this point. And, you know, we need to be exercising all of these things at various points, I think, particularly voice and exit. And, you know, so we're, you know, it's troubling because the video, the same video is still up on Facebook. We hosted on our site, you know, I guess it was maybe a year or two ago. We did a video about how do you make a ghost gun, you know, a gun that has never been registered anywhere using 3D printing. We knew YouTube wouldn't do it because they say, you know, they say they have a bunch of prescribed types of videos. So we actually did a promo video for it on YouTube, but we hosted it at Pornhub, which for a while was taking on all sorts of content, you know, and that's good. You know, it's good to patronize people who are letting you do your own thing and letting your, you know, fly your freak flag and all of that kind of stuff. But it's troubling. The best thing about it is, you know, and it's troubling from a principled perspective. I do think that Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all, you know, any website has a right to kick people off. I think that they are wrong and that the best way social media can be is to regulate or moderate very little and then give users the, you know, the tools or the ability to kind of tailor the experience to themselves. I'm amazed, by the way, at I spend too much time on Twitter. I know so many people who actually use top tweets, which is a default setting where Twitter kind of picks what they think you'll be interested in, as opposed to doing a chronological listing of your of the people you follow.
Right.
And, you know, it's like empower yourself. Use these platforms. Pit them against one another because there will be alternatives to these things. Host it yourself. You know, you run into trouble. I'm not a fan of Parler, but, you know, at a certain point, liberals were like, hey, you know, conservatives or libertarians or people we dub not liberal. If you don't like Twitter, you know, build your own, own Twitter. And, you know, that Parler did that. And then they were kind of getting screwed over. They're back, you know, they're back online and all of that kind of stuff. But we know we're in for a fight. A lot of these tech companies, you know, people like Ron DeSantis, you mentioned, he passed a law in Florida that, you know, makes it more difficult for a private company like Twitter to moderate its site the way it wants. That's fucked up, too. So we constantly have to be arguing for, I think, a better world, which is one where people are more relaxed and allow more speech. And then we also need to be threatening to leave or actually leaving and building alternatives in order to create a world in which, you know, more better speech is possible.
Yeah, I really agree on the, especially on the front that we need to be criticizing, because libertarians haven't been that heavily throttled because honestly, we're not as big of a threat as some people in the major parties. But, you know, I don't like Trump at all, but I was very against whenever they were removing him or deplatforming him, just because I knew it's coming down the pipe for us eventually. And, you know, same with Tulsi Gabbard. She was removed a lot. A lot of like Alex Jones types people, you know, I was just against all of it. I was like, you know,
I'm not, you know, it's what drives me nuts too, is that, you know, this is like H.L. Mencken's definition of Puritanism, you know, the idea that somebody somewhere might be enjoying themselves. Like it's an attempt to stamp out things. When Alex Jones got kicked off of YouTube and eventually Facebook and Twitter, people are like, you know, I, you know, I'm sick of, you know, going to Twitter or YouTube and coming across Alex Jones videos. I had to hunt him down, you know, because it's like, you know, like, do you have, you know, it was a joke on the Jetsons, you know, back in like the 60s, you know, that George Jetson, his whole job was like pushing a button a few times a day and his finger would throb from too much work. But it's like, you can mute these people. You can, with the touch of a button, you can be rid of people forever. And you're telling me that like Alex Jones is like harshing your vibe or something. It's like, come on, you know.
Yeah.
But what we need to do, and I think this is important from a libertarian perspective, is that, you know, we're in a moment now where everybody is getting more and more sensorial or censorious, you know, depending on who you talk to. There's, you know, the one way is the proper way to say that word. But people, it's not just that they don't want to have to deal with shit themselves in their timelines. They want to make sure that nobody anywhere ever sees anything they disagree with.
Right.
There's a right-wing version and a left-wing version of it. The libertarian perspective is the alternative to that, which is that, you know what? It's a better world when more stuff is out there. And let's learn how to live, you know, peacefully disagreeing with stuff that is not, you know, and it's not just like minor stuff. It's stuff that we really disagree with. But And I think, you know, we will win that argument because free speech is better than repressed speech. Because like you were saying, everybody knows in the back of their head that like the minute that, you know, the lights start going out, you know, God is going to come for your door. You know, he's going to pass over your door, too. And if you don't have the right light on, you know, you're going to get censored. So, you know, we need to build a consensus for free speech, which again, you know, is relatively, it's like a post-World War II phenomenon. I mean, it really kind of kicked into high gear. I talk about this a lot. It, you know, you couldn't even publish Lady Chatterley's Lover or, you know, Tropic of Cancer, Howl, poems and literature that are not even considered particularly, you know, avant-garde these days. You know, it took until the early 60s for this stuff to be able to be published without threat of censorship again, or obscenity trials against publishers. We had a brief moment in the 90s when the World Wide Web became the way that people access the internet, where free speech was, you know, wide open. The, you know, the powers that be and the powers that want to be are clawing that back every minute. And we have to keep, you know, we have to keep like maintaining the perimeter. Otherwise, we'll get overrun with censors.
Yeah. You're out there in the mainstream media world. You see how people perceive us. Mm-hmm. Kind of related to what we're talking about right now, John Brennan, I forget if it was in January or February, he came out with this thing about how we need to crack down on, he named bigots, right wingers, religious extremists, and then libertarians were in that list too.
Yeah.
I was wondering, what do you feel like the public's general perception of libertarians is? And do you think that was actually a positive thing that John Brennan said that about us? Because initially it was kind of horrifying, and it still is kind of horrifying, but at the same time, it's like, okay, if that's what John Brennan is saying about us, you know, I kind of like being the opposition to John Brennan. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
And again, he is the establishment. He is the elite. He is the center of American governance. So it is in that sense, it's nice to be included on his enemies list, you know, just like it must have been great to be. I mean, how many people must have been disappointed when Nixon's enemy list came out and they weren't on it?
Right.
Like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, how are you wasting your life? But I think there is a problem with some public perceptions of libertarianism in that, and most, I think they're mistaken, you know, for the most part. But I think, you know, that people think of libertarians as, you know, kind of oftentimes as conservatives who want to smoke pot. You hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. As people who don't care about empathy, you know, have no empathy, no sympathy, people who are overwhelmingly and kind of unforgivably white and upper middle class and upper educated, which has, you know, there's some truth to that, but it's not my experience. I mean, one of the things that drew me to libertarianism is that I've always liked weirdos, and like, you know, libertarians are like, you know, that's like, we are the freak show. We're the Ramones song Pinhead, you know, that ends with the invocation from a classic movie called Freaks, you know, one of us, we accept you. And I think that's largely true, but I think we need to also think about ways where the libertarian movement is heavily identified with a particular type of economic thinking, which I think sometimes is over-emphasized. I think what we need to be talking about is always about the idea, going back to, you know, what I was saying before, about like what we're about is a world in which everybody gets an opportunity to live the life that they envision for themselves, to build the world that they want to live in. And that means you're going to be creating all kinds of communities. That means you're going to be creating all kinds of weird experiments in living that John Stuart Mill talked about in the 19th century. And, you know, and you have to have tolerance, and you have to have an open mind about stuff, because, you know, one of the great things about a world like, you know, in the United States or online, you know, is like the idea that people are doing all kinds of weird living experiments all the time on big, you know, on a big scale and on a small scale. Same thing with business enterprises and things like that. And you see what people are doing, and you say like, oh, you know what, like, I don't like all of that, but I'm going to take that part of it and, you know, put it into my world, et cetera. I mean, like, I think to the extent that libertarians talk more about freedom and, you know, focus on the ways in which state power especially, but also corporate power sometimes fucks over people, you know, minorities, both, you know, ethnic and racial minorities, but also gender minorities, but also, you know, economic minorities, poor people, things like that. We have a long list where many of our issues, oftentimes without being acknowledged as libertarian hobby horses, are at front and center today. And that includes things like criminal justice reform, about reforming police, about getting rid of stupid things like, you know, drug laws and drug prohibition, not allowing the state to snuff out or to illegalize or ban, you know, or treat, you know, people who have different sexuality, you know, as second or third class citizens. Like, there's so much of what libertarians believe in that defines what is good and noble about contemporary debates. We might also want to take some more credit for that.
Yeah, it seems like it's an uphill battle. No matter how hard we try to convince them we're good, they're still going to group us in with people who don't represent us no matter what. I mean,
well, and you know what? I'll tell you, I'm sorry to jump in, but no, it's like, You know, that happens on the left, because it'll be like, okay, well, you know, like, yeah, you guys, I mean, you know, look, Reason Magazine was founded in 1968. And like in the first couple of issues, they were, you know, the guys who founded it were talking about things like drug legalization, you know, marriage equality, changing police structures and giving people more freedom from, you know, all sorts of laws. But then, you know, when you bring this up, you know, some people on the left will be like, well, you don't believe in, you know, like rigid quota systems for preferential treatment. So fuck you. You're as bad as anybody on the right, or you're a religious nut, even if, right, you know, libertarianism came out of religious freedom struggles in the 17th century in England. You know, but then on the right, it's kind of like, oh, you don't believe in God, or you believe that markets, you know, shouldn't be as heavily restrained or regulated as I want, or that certain speech is not merely obscene, but it's blasphemous. So you're a commie, you know, and it's like we shouldn't spend too much time trying to be, you know, winking and trying to pick up right wingers and left wingers, because these are tribal affiliations. What we need to be doing is like building the case. You know, this is the world that libertarians want to live in. And you know what? It tastes good. It smells good. It looks good. And it's going to be changing over time because it's interested in innovation and change, mongrelizing, hybridizing, coming up with new and interesting ways of being, new and interesting works of art and, you know, of commerce, come along with that. Like, but, you know, you can waste your whole life, you know, preaching, you know, trying to convert people who are just lost souls.
Yeah, for sure. When it comes to libertarians, you know, there's that old, I'm more libertarian than you. I'm the only real libertarian in the room, yeah, no matter how minute the difference is. I've been really trying to get libertarians to focus on the big central issues that draw us together, especially the ones that are very pressing right now. Like, right, you said, free speech, you know, with the COVID state that we've had over the last year, there's been, yeah, a lot of, you know, invasion, yeah, on privacy and business rights, you know, all this
and
stuff.
You know, so, I do think with that, like, by the way, one of the, you know, of among all of the many things, and we will not fully understand the wreckage caused to our daily lives by, you know, kind of infractions on liberty in the name of COVID for a long time. But for me, one of the worst things was, you know, that the government had the gall to start defining businesses as essential or non-essential, you know, right, and that was at the, you know, mostly at the state and local level. I live in New York State, New York City. And, you know, it's like, you know, you're telling me people like Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio are you know, actually dictating what's important to me. That's a good entry point, because everybody in New York was like pissed, and, you know, and it's not like any of this stuff worked. So you can build, you know, from people's empirical experience with this stuff into a pretty good case, you know, for at least thinking about libertarianism. I think you're right. You know, people are always, libertarians are always like looking, it's almost like you talk to somebody long enough until you can disagree with them and then tell them you're the worst libertarian in the world. You're not even libertarian. Right. You're my enemy. That's a bad mindset. And it gets in the way of having the types of conversations that not only will pull more people in our direction, but actually stop the kind of coalitions that might change things. A couple of, you know, it's probably like 10 years ago, I interviewed Ralph Nader, right? Okay, you know, who's like a big lefty. Mm-hmm. You know, he is like the ultimate boomer icon of kind of, you know, like muscular interventionist government, public health, all of this kind of stuff. And he had written a book where he was saying, you know, basically progressives and libertarians agree on, like, you know, all of these issues. And if they would just shut the fuck up about what divides them and start focusing on things like, you know, corporate welfare, you know, was a big one. You know, like we have the numbers combined to like make change. And so he sat down and I immediately went into like, you know, but you're in favor of like nationalized healthcare. And he's like, Nick, you're doing it, you know. And it's like I was interviewing about this book about how like we have the numbers if we can just focus on discrete topics and policies. And I think that's, you know, that's a lesson that we need to be learning on, you know, on an hourly basis.
Yeah, it's funny because two icons of libertarianism and progressivism are Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
And they did that all the time and they wouldn't budge on their principles. You know, there was no, somehow people think you know, working together where you agree is compromise, where right. it doesn't have to be. You can be as stalwart as you want and just say, hey, you know, you and I agree on this. Even if we disagree on everything else, this is one issue we really care about right now. So let's fix it.
Right. And, you know, that is one of the, you know, the major legislative changes. And, you know, on a certain level, legislative changes are important, but it's also, you know, I think the vast majority of important, meaningful things still happen beyond politics. But the sphere of politics keeps growing. So we need to like punch it down, you know, like dough that is sitting in a, you know, in a basket. You know, almost all major legislative changes happen because a new consensus is reached that we are going to do this or that. And that's often bad. I mean, that's like things like, you know, Social Security or, you know, growing out the welfare state into things like Medicare in the late 60s. But that's also how things change in terms of things like drug legalization. You know, we now have solid 2/3 to 3/4 of people in America who believe that marijuana should be legal and other drugs are going to follow in that. And we need to activate, you know, on that. And we need to build those large super majorities that then politicians have no choice but to actually bend to, you know, the general will. One of the things that is interesting to me is how often, we think politicians lead, but almost never is that the case. They follow. So it's really up to us who want to affect social, cultural, political change to like get, you know, to build out that new consensus. And then eventually, you know, politics is a lagging indicator of where we are as a society. And so, you know, we've got a lot of stuff to deal with, both in terms of public health outrages, you know, out of COVID. We're still dealing with the aftermath of 9/11 and a national security state that was insane and a textbook case of hysteria. We have a lot of speech coalitions building, you know, anti-speech coalitions, which is worrisome to me when you have right-wing conservatives. When you had Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the 2020 election, each of them were saying, you know, we got to get rid of Section 230 of the Communications mm-hmm. Decency Act. We got to break up Facebook. We got to, you know, kick Google in the balls and stuff like that. They were doing it for slightly different reasons, but like that's bad because they're going to team up and they're going to screw us over because, you know, it gets them what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as the liberty movement goes, I mean, we should be, it seems like we should be the ones that get along the easiest because we all want to live and let live. And, right. you know, we just want to leave each other alone. So it seems like it would be the easiest.
We are
group to
so
get along.
Good. We are so wonderful and nice and beautiful and fresh smelling. Yeah, we should be at the front of every parade.
Yeah, but we're obviously not. And, you know, when I joined the Libertarian Party officially last mm-hmm. year, and I'm a fan of a bunch of different people. I like Tom Woods. I like Dave Smith. I like Spike mm-hmm. Cohen. I liked you. I like Ron Paul. I liked Rand mm-hmm. Paul. I like Thomas Matt. And then there are all these people telling me that I have to hate. Like, you can't like both yeah. of those people. That's not allowed. And I'm like, right. Why? I'm a libertarian. Are you kidding? I'm in like this little subset of culture in this yeah. country. And I'm supposed to hate people that, you know, have different messaging or a different style than I do. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I think so. You know, I think part of the problem is when, you know, libertarians, I seriously believe that being libertarian is a pre-political kind of temperament or mindset. So you could be a libertarian Republican, you could be a libertarian Democrat. I knew a bunch of people who were really big on free speech and they were libertarian, but you know, they were Democrats and they, you know, they were comfortable with a much bigger regulatory state than I would be. Right. But you know, then again, like, you know, they were, you know, I remember years ago watching a show that it was like, you know, ABC this week or something with like David Brinkley or George Stephanopoulos, and Barney Frank was on and Paul Ryan was on. And Barney Frank said, you know what, like, you know, I'll give up certain types of welfare payments, Paul Ryan, if you'll give up the, you know, the military industrial complex and certain types of speech codes, you know, or allow abortion. And I was like, ah, you know what, like Barney Frank in many ways was like the definition of an ultra liberal big government guy, but you know, he was at least as a libertarian as Paul Ryan, you know, who oftentimes was, Paul, because Paul Ryan had once said something nice about Ayn Rand, he was perceived to be, you know, a super, night watchman state guy, which wasn't true at all. So, you know, we need to think more about that. I think what I'm getting at, though, is with the LP, the LP has been around 50 years. It still has something of an identity crisis in that it hasn't made a full decision, it seems to me. Does it want to be an actual political party whose primary function is to find candidates and run them for office, get into office and be part of the political machinery? Or is it a kind of outreach program that is that is defining purist libertarianism? And as a result, you get a lot of that. I think there's a lot of tension there, which is obviously playing out in the party. I have to say also, like, I like the Libertarian Party, with the exception of my first presidential vote, which was in 1984, when I, in a way that I have trouble, thinking, I can't access why I did this, but I voted for Walter Mondale, mostly because he said he would raise taxes in order to reduce the deficit. And I thought that was honest, at least. But every presidential election I've been in, I vote for the Libertarian. Every election that I vote in, I vote for the Libertarian, even though I'm not a member of the LP. We're coming off this weird thing where there's obviously there's people are vying for control of the party. Not surprisingly, after we've had three presidential elections where the Libertarian, has had historically high numbers. So I guess, now people are fighting over the meaning of the Libertarian Party, because if it doesn't quite have a seat at the table, it's at least like second or third in the line to be let in when, when the club opens up.
Yeah. Do you think the Libertarian can be Libertarian Party can be both of those things, and, a beacon of liberty and like a thought machine, but also try to get people into office? Do you think that,
I don't know. I don't know, and it may be that, like, what libertarians do, that the role that we play in American politics, like American culture and American business, is that maybe we're 10% of the population or 20% of the population, and that we're going to be kind of out there leading the direction of where things are going or could be going, but we're not going to be, actually in power, in political power. I don't know. When I look at people, like I thought Gary Johnson, who is, widely dismissed among, purist libertarians. It's like, he fucked up, on the campaign trail in various ways. But like, the 2016 results that he brought to bear in an election that was hotly contested, he more than covered the spread between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Without Gary Johnson, it's not exactly clear who, that Trump would have gotten in, or, maybe Hillary would have won by a wider margin. I don't know, but it's like, but he was pretty good. And he introduced a lot of people to a general sensibility that was live and let live. I think that, I think that's not a small thing. I look at people like Justin Amash, who, actually affiliated with Congress as a libertarian. I think somebody like Justin Amash, to be quite honest, could deliver us, into a different realm, because I think he is very thoughtful and he is a consistent thinker, and he is also like a really good messenger. And he's a serious guy who's actually been in office. I mean, part of the problem with the LP is that virtually very few of the candidates who rise to any level it's not just that they haven't held office, they haven't been serious about politics. So, right. You have Ron Paul in 1988, having been a congressman, did very poorly. His real work has been as a Republican, but you have Gary Johnson, a Republican governor who did well. You have somebody like Justin Amash who could be, a presidential candidate or could be a major player in the party. I think he might be a game changer. And, in this recent flap between the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire and the Libertarian National Committee, I don't know all the details. I only know what I've read online. But Amash said at one point, you know, and I, and this is why he's like, he's a different type of character. He said, you know, that the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire elected this certain group of people. And even if you don't like that, you don't like what they're doing, like, that's due process. Like, you can't just kick them out because you don't like their messaging.
Right.
But then he also said, you know, the messaging of the LP of New Hampshire is fucked up and stupid. I mean, he didn't use those terms because he's a polite, you know, Christian man. But, you know, and he was like, you know, we need to be thoughtful of what are the messages. And, you know, we share a vision for what America could look like. How are we going to get more people to join our bandwagon rather than, you know, kind of, you know, seeing who has the biggest, you know, libertarian bona fides.
Yeah, I think also that a lot of people want one message. And I understand when you elect a presidential candidate, you are kind of settling on one message. But during the in-between time, when as long as we're all selling the same product, if we have different styles that reach different people, I think that's great. You know, like Dave Smith and Justin Amash and Spike Cohen and you and me and all these people, we all have different techniques that reach people that otherwise wouldn't be reached. And I think that's great. And it's kind of what you were talking about earlier with the more of a product you have, the better you can see what works better. So many people want everyone else to come to libertarianism the same way they did.
Right.
And it's like, look, dude, that's, I mean, my story is partially through Bill Maher. How many people come to libertarianism through Bill Maher? You know, like that's not a, that's not a typical thing.
And so we need to be multiplying, you know, the kind of narratives or the faces of libertarians. You know, one of the things, you know, I was born in 1963, so I'm actually like a very late boomer, you know, part of the boomer generation of all things. But, you know, millennials and Gen Z, there are more millennials than baby boomers. There are going to shortly, there will be more Gen Z than baby boomers. Like that's where the bodies are. And we need to figure out how to appeal to younger people and not by, you know, being like Steve Buscemi, you know, in a Saturday Night Live sketch and pretending to be cool or hip. We need to be finding people who understand, have a native grasp of what it means to be a libertarian and can talk to people on their own terms about like, you know, millennials and Gen Z come from a lot of different backgrounds. You know, America, they are more multi-ethnic than baby boomers were, for instance. There is more regional variation now. There are more class differences that we need to be talking to because, you know, if you come to libertarianism because your father owned a country club and you understood how like certain kinds of regulations kind of, you know, hurt his profit margin, that is very different than if you're growing up, you know, in a lower middle class background or a low class background. And you come here from another country because you have the opportunity to do hard labor and you get screwed over by occupational licensing. You know, we need when I was running Reason Magazine, what part of my journalism background was in teen magazine. So I always think about this type of stuff in music magazines. We need to have like a village people approach where there are like 5 or 10 or 20 or an infinite number of different characters on the stage, all of whom will develop a constituency that is appealing and is attractive and people can look up and be aspirational towards or see their experience being channeled and being acknowledged and respected and elucidated. So I'm with you. I mean, we need more variation, not, you know, one, you know, monoculture. This is libertarians, you know, and if you don't like it, get the fuck out. You know, that's just not going to work.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't follow you all the time, so I don't know, but it seems like you kind of get along with everybody in the liberty movement. I don't know if that's true, but
no, I trust me, and my sons never miss an opportunity to send me, you know, nasty memes and or put downs from, you know, certain types of libertarians. So, okay. And also, you know, like I get shit on by, you know, Democrats and, you know, Republicans or liberals and conservatives. But, you know, the point is just like all of us, we should be in the mix. Like we should, you know, and like think about like if you care about libertarian ideas and you want to build a libertarian universe, like, and again, I'm not saying like you hide what you believe, you know, totally the opposite, but like, how do you engage people in a way where you're not the biggest asshole in the room, where you're actually kind of like saying the types of things that are interesting? you know, what we are witnessing in America, and, you know, and this has been like a long, steady decline, you know, at least 50 years, we're witnessing the hollowing out of trust and confidence in government, in, you know, in big business, certainly, in, you know, the wise people who can run the world. You know, we have really good opportunities to start up conversations with people who are unhappy, who don't trust people, who don't believe in things. Like, you know, our institutions have failed us. And let's start talking about, okay, here's how we can have an alternative set of institutions that might actually, you know, engage people rather than alienate them.
Yeah. Do you think that they're boiling the frog too fast now? I was a bit of an accelerationist, and I actually sort of wanted Biden to win because I think he's a little bit worse than Trump. They're both terrible, but Biden seems to be more accelerationist. He seemed like someone who could not pretend to be an ally of liberty at all, where Trump was good at pretending that he was. So a lot of people were kind of asleep. But now that Trump's gone, Biden's here. They're just not pretending to be conservative at all. You know, there's no there's no holds barred when it comes to spending, when it comes to cracking down on, you know, businesses with coronavirus there for a while. Seems like they're kind of backing off on that. But
and also then, like, you know, the idea that Biden was going to rescind all of these terrible things that Trump did,
right,
you know, like trade policy, immigration, closing the borders. And he's not. And he's also dragging his feet on freaking marijuana legalization,
right,
you know, which is like he was, you know, I mean, this is like, I'm not a fan of Trump, but in 2016 and again in 2020, Trump has, you know, said, like, put anything on my desk, you know, that remains, you know, marijuana and eventually, I would assume, other drug legalization, putting it back to the states, I'll sign it. Biden can't go there. And so I don't know if it's accelerationist. And I also don't know if I want to go to the end of night, you know, as fast as possible, as opposed to just get on a different highway altogether, right? But Biden is going to make it harder and harder for people to be like, okay, you know, like this guy's in charge and he's charting a different course and a better course. All he is doing is printing, you know, more money than can actually be shoved out the door and things like that. And, The contradictions of, you know, of the political class, you know, are being shoved in our face more and more. I think, you know, a lot of this depends also on like how the Republicans respond. You know, and at this point, they don't seem to know what they're doing. You know, there's a big group of them that are waiting for Trump, you know, to get some more monkey gland shots and kind of show up, you know, rested and tanned and ready for 2024. That seems insane to me. And that also gives the Libertarian Party, but also more broadly cultural libertarians, you know, it gives us the opportunity to be having a lot of conversations about stuff, you know, that wouldn't be happening otherwise.
Yeah. So let's end with this. What looks like success to you? What is the best case scenario that can happen? Let's say by 2024, electorally, culturally, what do you, what are some main things you want to see change in a libertarian perspective?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess it's weird because like I really do, you know, the reason I'm a libertarian ultimately is that I believe that the most important parts of our lives are outside of politics. Politics is a zero sum game and we need to, you know, and it is like there are, I'm not an anarchist. I believe that government is going to be here and it's right to be here. And there are certain things it's always going to be doing. But it's a zero-sum game and 50% of the population plus one vote gets to shove their version of things down other people's throats. So you want that part of your life to be as small as possible. It looked like, you know, in the late 90s, it looked like that was possible, you know, and now we're back in an age of, you know, big government is, you know, nobody is trying to put a stop to it. So that's a real problem. But I think if in 2024, if we are still anti-interventionist, anti-military intervention, and we've opened up our borders to, you know, people who want to come here and live peacefully and legally, if we've reopened our trade, you know, our trade routes, if we've gotten rid of occupational licensing, if we, you know, this conversation is getting started, if we are further down the road to like rethinking occupational licensing, which has been growing over the past 50 years, if more drugs are legal in more places, if, you know, if speech is less fraught and people are like, you know what, we're going back or we're embracing an ethic of, I don't might not like what you talk about, but you have a right to do it and, you know, change my mind. Type of stuff. I think that's all, you know, that kind of cultural stuff. If the economy is gearing up and people are trying to make interesting and new businesses and things like that, that's all good. I don't know exactly how you quantify that. In terms of electoral changes, like, I mean, you know, it is true that the size, scope, and spending of government is kind of the measure of, like, you know, how big government is. It's true that government can grow and freedom can grow. Our ability to live however we want can grow because sometimes gatekeeper institutions or social conventions break down and people are allowed to kind of live crazy lives. So, you know, it's hard to get all of that. But I'm hopeful, you know, that by 2024, one thing that I do believe will happen is that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats are going to have a strong majority. We have been in an era of no decision where, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats keep swapping control of the White House, the Senate and Congress. I think the longer that lasts, people will understand these are two false choices. And we need to finally embrace a 21st century, which is open ended, which is more geared towards giving people the right and the opportunity to figure out how to live their lives rather than, you know, this group saying I'm an expert and you're going to live my way, or, you know, this group saying I'm the expert, you're going to live my way. I don't know. I'm sorry to be vague in, you know, in that sense. And I also hope, you know, I mean, electorally, I suppose I hope that the Libertarian Party is cracking, you know, 5 or 10% in presidential elections. And as important is on the debate stage nationally, but is also kind of creeping into state houses where, you know, a ton of stuff gets done, in city halls where a ton of stuff gets done. Because, you know, to go back to my experience as like a cub reporter for the Home News in New Brunswick, it's, you know, I lived for 20 years in a small town in Ohio, you know, local government, you know, which we sometimes extol because it's closer to people, et cetera. It's right. Like, you know, in a lot of ways, when the, you know, the people running you are in, you know, you see them in the grocery store aisle, man, right. that boot on your neck feels a lot worse. And it's a lot more meaningful, you know, at least Washington, they're kind of idiots. And, you know, I can be out here, you know, Bitcoin mining in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, DC may not know about it, but, you know, my town councilman, but, you know, if there's more of a libertarian sensibility at the local level, at the state level, and the federal level, I think that would be great.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having that conversation, Nick. That was great. This is really cool, you know, coming full circle like this after 7 years of being in this movement to actually talk to you face to face. I really appreciate it. If there's anywhere that you want people to follow you, obviously Reason Magazine and your Twitter
Reason.com is great. And I'm, you know, at Nick Gillespie on Twitter. I think it's Gillespie Nick at Instagram. And go to YouTube, Reason TV's YouTube channel. If you just type in Reason TV, all one word, you'll get our videos, which are pulling, you know, 6.5 million views a month just on YouTube. That, and, you know, the bigger our traffic, maybe the fewer of our videos will get, you know, get stricken from the public record. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for tuning in, everyone. I will be streaming again on Thursday night. It's going to be the fourth Four Horsemen video with Scott Horton, Ryan Dawson, and Eric Jackman. So check in for that. I'll be doing it live from Porkfest, and I'll also be at Porkfest Thursday and Friday for anyone who's going. And thank you, Nick. I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.